right. Many thanks to each of our board members for their remarks. And with that, we'll now start with the Q&A session. If you would like to ask a question, please do the following. First, make sure that Zoom is the only active chat program open on your computer, as other programs might interfere with your ability to engage. Second, make sure your microphone is activated within Zoom. And third, use the raise hand function. We will register your interest in asking a question, and then if it's your turn, I will call your name and a pop-up window will open on your screen. And when you see this pop-up window, please unmute yourself to ask your question. And your camera, of course, will remain off. So, enough about the logistics. Let's get started. And let me see where the first question comes from. Patricia Weiss from Reuters. Patricia, over to you.
Good morning to London. I hope you can hear me now. You said you wanted to cut the management layers to 5 to 6. In terms of people, can you tell us now how many jobs will be affected by the cutbacks? Secondly, you said that you are updating Bayer's legal strategy, pursuing new approaches. This includes more intensive cooperation with other players in the field of politics. What exactly does that mean? And last question, you declared the pharma pipeline as a top priority, but you also emphasized that buying phase 3 assets is an expensive game with a lot of risk. How do you want to strengthen the pipeline? Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Patricia. So on the question of how many jobs, we couldn't really give a precise figure today because our approach is fundamentally different than the typical restructuring approach that companies do. And we've all been, you know, part of these exercises in the past where, you know, there's a target, like a 10% reduction, and then everyone sort of gets the target, they take out their org chart, and they eliminate 10% of the boxes. That's not at all what we're doing. We don't start with a target. We start with a quest to basically maximize the ability of our people on the ground to take action fast, take action today to help customers, take action today to drive innovation forward. And we basically take out everything that hinders that, every step that is like a hurdle, we take that out, and that ends up being the sort of cost savings part of dynamic shared ownership. So we couldn't tell you how many jobs it'll be. We know it'll be substantial. I think we've given examples, like in the US recently, in pharma, they took out about 40% of the management jobs, but there will be a broad range, and we'll provide more updates on that as we go. In terms of the legal strategy, I think I addressed this pretty thoroughly in my talk. I want to make clear we're on this. This is a top priority. It's not somewhere off to the side, but it's front and center for us. And we're not going to say much more than what I just said. Because I think you'll agree, it doesn't make sense for us to give our adversaries the litigation industry, and it is an industry. We're not giving them our playbook in advance. So thanks for the questions on that. Maybe, Stefan, would you like to talk about, is there a tension between saying we're not buying phase 3 assets on the one hand, but we do want to bolster our pharma pipeline? How would you answer that?
Thank you. So, Patricia, thanks for this excellent question. This is a priority that we've been dealing with now for a number of years. How can we bolster our pipeline in our pharmaceuticals business? Now, you also need to understand that if you stay away from doing probably not value-adding late-stage deals, it's something that you don't fix overnight. So what we've been working on, what we continue tirelessly to work on, is really to fix our overall approach to our R&D model. And that means looking at the capabilities that we have, and you've seen us make continued investments in platform capabilities and in earlier deals. Over 120 deals over the last 5 years is one area. The other thing is how to improve focus. So we've clearly outlined that we want to focus around four areas that we see most interest for us, and most unmet need being in cardiovascular medicine and oncology, being in neurology and rare disease, and being in the area of immunology, where we believe we have unique capabilities paired to strong unmet need. And then it's about the quality. We need to advance now all of these early assets that we've added to our pipeline faster through the funnel. So to make a very promising early pipeline converted over the next 3 years into a promising late-stage pipeline. And then let's not forget that when you look at the size of the problem that we're facing with loss of exclusivity of Xarelto and Eylea, which are not small problems, that we have significant opportunities with the products that either are being launched right now or that are gearing up to get ready for launch. So we have a number of candidates that have put blockbuster potential over the coming years. And with the addition of acoramidis that we added yesterday, I think we get more credibility on our late stage shots on goal. So all of this obviously needs to continue, and we will continue to make reasonable and measured investments into rather earlier deals, trying to advance them as fast as we can. Thank you.
Okay, and the next question comes from Olaf Storbeck. Olaf, again, over to you.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yep, we can hear you.
Cool. Yeah, I would like to pick up Patricia's question on the job cut again, because I mean, you gave a number on the cost cuts you're expecting by 2026 from DSO, which is 2 billion. As you have 10.7 billion in personal expenses at the moment, which is kind of, that's a reduction of 18%. Does this kind of, if I infer that about 18% of your staff has to go, which would be like between 15,000 to 18,000 people, would that be completely misleading, or is this kind of roughly in the area what you expect? Because, I mean, you must know where the 2 billion are coming from, or is this different costs than expenses? That would be my first question, and I have a few more, which I would like to ask later.
Yeah. So, Olaf, maybe at a high level, I could say there's a number of things that go into this, and of course, it also has to do with the fact that these are management jobs. They tend to be more expensive jobs, and the higher up you go, the more expensive it is. So you can't translate from a cost savings number to a percent of workforce. I think our focus, again, is take everything out of the way that's coming between our people at the ground level, offering a new solution for a customer today, advancing a product faster. And as we look at that and sort of estimate the different effects it could be, we come up with about 2 billion. We think we can deliver that. And yeah, we're quite confident in it.
You also had some other questions, Olaf. Maybe you ask them all and we collect them and then we answer them on block.
It seems to be otherwise difficult echo-wise and stuff. So could you give us an estimate how much the DSO initiatives will cost you per year by 2026? And then I have a question on leverage, or a few questions on leverage. One is, you said that in a potential split, you would be expecting to the leverage for these different units would go up at least temporarily. Could you explain why? Because I mean, the earning flows or the income flows would remain the same, or should remain the same in a split. I don't really understand that. And then the other question on, you said debt will come down by 1 to 2 billion euros this next year in 2024. If I got that right, as you already, I mean, that's only the dividend cut more or less, kind of, which translates into lower debt, while free cash flow is expected to be up significantly as well. Why isn't the deleveraging kind of going faster? And what else are you going to do with the cash?
Yeah, Olaf, I'll take a cut at this and then others can supplement. The 2 billion savings will obviously produce one-time cost. They will be lower as a factor of the savings when compared to previous programs. You will probably recall that we always talked about 1.5, 1.7x. This time you will see this closer to 1x. has to do with the makeup of the actions for the most part. Let me address the debt first. It is our top priority to advancing towards a single A rating, very clear. I think that became also clear through the dividend cut. Good question on why the free cash flow doesn't translate all the way to the net financial debt, and that has simply to do that there are certain factors between free cash flow and the overall change in cash. For instance, milestone payments that we have on M&A action that we did in the past that are still outstanding. It could be certain provisions to pensions. It is indeed the dividend that you mentioned, and we have also provisioned for some further FX fluctuation there as well. So we'll obviously try to optimize that number, but that is really those are the main factors going in there. And last but not least, when you look at a spin or an IPO, as Bill mentioned, there's many factors that you look at, and one of them is time to money. Right, and in an IPO, it takes you 2 or 3 years, if you're lucky, to get the shares sold. But in the meantime, you're accumulating a lot of cost. It's one-time cost of rewiring the systems. It is potential tax leakage that you could incur depending on how the transaction is structured. And that will all drive up your cost, profitability down, leverage up. And then don't forget, when you sell a business, you're also giving away the profit of that business, and that will also have an impact on leverage. So I hope that gives you a few pointers to your questions.
Thank you. And the next question comes from Ludwig Burger, Reuters. Ludwig, over to you.
Thank you very much, and good morning. A question for Bill, if I can, on... you've hinted in your release on the dividend measures that you had a conversation with shareholders, and now today you've called off specific measures on the structure. I wonder what is your sense of how this will go down with the shareholders, some of which have requested, have really urged you to reconsider or to review the structure of the company, and specifically now with Jeffrey Ubben to join the supervisory board. I'd be really curious how are you getting along with him? What is Jeffrey Ubben's, what are his ideas? What does he bring to the table? Will he be happy about you calling off restructuring measures or group structure changes over the by up to 3 years? Thank you.
Ludwig, thanks for the questions. So, regarding this decision to defer any sort of structural measures, at least for the next 2 to 3 years, we've had an opportunity to have many, many dialogues with major shareholders, frankly, over the whole time I've been at the company. And it's clear that there's been a lot of calls for a breakup for the reasons I mentioned, that a pure play structure is simple, most of our competitors are pure play. But our major shareholders also understand the nitty-gritty of corporate breakups. And they understand that there's one-time costs. They understand that there's considerable tax leakage, and they understand that the present valuation environment is not particularly favorable. And so I think what we've heard mostly from them is, hey, we need to do what's best for the company in the long term. And I think that they understand that the four topics that I've mentioned, these four challenges, they're things that we need to address, and that the time that it takes for some sort of major financial structure change is time we can't afford to lose in addressing those topics. With respect to Jeffrey Ubben, I won't speak for him. That's not my job. But I can say that he's been a productive member of a number of boards. I had an opportunity to talk to CEOs from other companies that have worked with him over the years. And I think he's known by shareholders as someone who advocates very squarely for the best thing for the shareholders. But I think he's known for management, for someone who's highly intelligent and focused on really adding value and how companies add value. So I look forward, I think, as we all do, to having his input from our supervisory board, as well as the other new and old members.
Okay, next question comes from Jonas Janssen, Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung. Jonas, over to you.
Hi, thank you, and good morning to London. I wanted to ask if you can share a little bit more about the glyphosate plans, not like the legal topic, but more on the financials, because you had a big effect in the last year. What are your plans with glyphosate in the future, and maybe, and then there we come to the legal part. How big will the role of glyphosate be in the next years for Bayer?
So let me take that question. So what we had, and we're going to share more details this afternoon. But basically, when you think about glyphosate, we had 22 as an exceptional year, and now we're back into a normal situation for glyphosate. And that's how we are guiding for the future as well, for next year. We are basically guiding based on 15 years average of the glyphosate price for the coming 24 season, what allow us to focus really on the core business. The core business is all the innovation that we bring is in the core, and that's why we reinforced the performance of last year of 7% growth on the core business. We're planning another growth for 24, and this is the foundation of based on our innovation, our new launches in the seeds and traits and in CP and the digital technology. So we are managing glyphosate as a more volatile business, guiding for the 15 years, but highly focused on the core business and how we deliver that innovation to the farmers. Thank you for your question.
Yeah, and I might just add, in terms of future plans, Bayer is, I think, as many of you know, we're the largest investor in R&D for agriculture, for the future of feeding the world and ensuring we can do it in a way that's also good for the planet. And glyphosate, today is a big part of that for the world. That's not Bayer's call. That's basically what the farmers tell us, that, hey, it's indispensable for allowing them to produce food at an affordable price for consumers in the developed world and in the emerging markets. So that's the situation today. Going forward, we're investing in a number of new herbicide projects. We are looking forward in, I think, 2028 to bring in the world the next sort of brand new, fundamentally new category of molecules as a herbicide. This is something that's really important, because weeds, fungi, insects, they all evolve. And if you just keep using the same protection products over time, they're going to break through and you're going to have problems. So, we look forward to a future of all the things Rodrigo said, that we're going to deliver agriculture for the world, food for the world, and we want to do that with better products.
Yeah, next in line is Amy Donnellan from Reuters. Amy, over to you.
Hi there. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay, great. I just had a question about, you talk about the reasons why it doesn't make sense to sell the consumer business. And one of them is that you talk about tax leakage and extra costs. I wonder if you could maybe talk us through a little bit about what the tax leakage is exactly, and what those extra costs are.
Yeah, I'll keep it simple. And if there's more, so the tax leakage, it's kind of simple. On a company's balance sheet, you have a value for the assets. So we have a value for the assets of consumer health sitting on our balance sheet. Those are by product or in some cases whole business lines. And basically, if you sell something for more than the worth, then the tax authorities in various jurisdictions say, hey, that you just made a profit, because the value on your books is $1 billion and you sold it for $5 billion, so you made $4 billion in profit. So you need to write us a check for 30% of that, and 30% of that is $1.2 billion. So in that example, you have $5 billion of cash coming in, but you got to write a check for $1.2 billion. And where we're standing right now, the idea of writing checks to governments for selling things is not very appealing. So I think that's sort of the simple answer on the tax leakage. Extra cost is just, you know, right now we have one finance system for all of Bayer. We have one payroll department for all of Bayer. If we split, we got to have separate finance systems. We got to have separate payroll systems, and there's cost associated with that. So those are the kinds of costs that we're talking about.
Okay, and the next question comes from Tim Low from Bloomberg. Tim, over to you.
Hi, thanks. Yeah, Bill, your answer to the last question kind of sets me up for a question I had. And I have two here. First, I'll just ask, all along, one thing on my mind has been whether implicitly in this review, you've been sort of saying that pharma is core to Bayer, because you've talked about the possibility of selling off consumer health or doing something with crops. But I haven't heard anything about, I don't think there was ever a possibility of selling off pharma and keeping the other two. So that's question one. Is pharma somehow more core to Bayer than the others? The second question is, you just sort of discussed some of the reasons why now is not the time to engage in this split, and possibly for the next 24 to 36 months. If you were to decide in 2 years' time or 3 years' time that you do want to sell off consumer health or do something with crops, does that start the clock at, you know, at that point, and then you have to go through all of these steps that you're not wanting to do right now, in which case some sort of a separation is potentially 4 or 5 years away? Or are you going to start doing preparatory work now so that should you decide to sell off one of those pieces, you can do it very fast?
Yeah, thanks, Tim. Just maybe simply on the question of whether the fact that we didn't mention a sale or spin or IPO of pharma, is that because pharma is core? I don't know. Core, that can be sort of a feeling. And of course, we love our pharma business. We love being a part of, you know, providing solutions to the world for cancer and for Parkinson's disease and heart disease. That being said, that's not really why we didn't consider a pharma spin or a pharma sale. Fundamentally, it's just because right now there's a high degree of ambiguity around the pharma outlook because of the patent expirations. And so it probably wouldn't be a very smart time to try to spin it or try to IPO it. And likewise, you know, I don't think this would be a good time valuation-wise. So we just sort of took that off the table. And frankly, I don't think any of our investors have had any appetite for that option either. On the other question of, you know, if not now, if we went to do one of these structural moves in 2 to 3 years, does that mean the clock starts over? I think right now, as I said, we're really focused on these four things. If we can fix those four things, that gives us strategic flexibility. To be direct on your question of like, will the prep work start now? Not so much, other than we're preparing all of our businesses for a stronger future. I say that because in my example about having separate payroll systems, we're not going to start creating separate payroll systems. That would be an unproductive activity at the moment. And this is a time where we can't afford unproductive activities. We got to have everything focused on customers and product innovation. And so I'm confident that if in 2 to 3 years' time we decide a structural move is the right answer, we'll be able to execute that in an expeditious manner. Thanks, Tim.
Okay, Amy, I think you had a follow-up question that we couldn't hear in the room, but I would like to give you the opportunity to ask this. So again, to Amy from Reuters.
So three questions from me. One, in your guidance, you talk about lower EBITDA but higher free cash flow. Can you just explain to me what's different in terms of the cash conversion? Can you just explain, when you say that the present valuation environment isn't favorable for a consumer health sale, it doesn't strike me as terrible. We've had these reports about interest in the Sanofi consumer health business. Haleon's share price hasn't been a disaster. I'm just not totally sure what I see what you mean about the environment not being favorable. So just maybe can you clarify that? And also, can you just, you said that the supervisory board is preparing a new incentive scheme with the short-term focus on revenue growth, profitability and cash, and the long-term more aligned to outcomes for shareholders. Can you just be a bit more specific about what that means? Is there a, I mean, obviously, that with the share price at a 20-year low, this it would be obvious to have a bigger focus on the share price as part of that. But I just wanted to understand what's in store there. Although I appreciate you're not the supervisory board.
Hey, Stephen, it's Wolfgang. I'll take your first one, and then Bill is going to, I guess, address the other two. Good catch there. Yeah, profitability is going down, both on the EBITDA and the EPS level, but free cash flow is going up. I would point to three major factors. Number one, even though we are not spelling it out, we are planning on less settlements in 24 than we paid out in 23. A second reason is that the timing of STI payouts, or short-term incentive payouts, in the following year influences the cash flow. So you can imagine in 23 we paid the incentive systems, the incentive entitlements for 22, which was very high. And in 24, we're paying for 23, which is very low. So you see a difference there. And certainly, we're really intensely focused on working capital and CapEx management. We could go into every area, inventory, AP, AR, we'll attack everything. And we expect progress there as well, which obviously also helps to leverage the cash flow over the profitability. Bill?
Yep. Yeah, and Stephen, regarding your question about valuations and why do we think that the valuations are not sort of optimal right now in consumer health, I think it's just a simple look at some of the facts that there have been the two largest consumer health businesses that are part of other companies, one of those being Bayer, that there have been discussions about those being separate or made separate for a number of years now. And you haven't seen it happen yet. And in an environment where valuations are high, typically an acquiring company is knocking on the door and putting down the money. And that sort of hasn't happened yet, right? So I think we have a lot of conversations with investment bankers and with other leaders in industry, and that's basically the read of the land. On the question about alignment of LTI, maybe just simply put, the current LTI structure for senior managers has 20% on ESG measures, 40% that's basically tied to the share price, and 40% that's tied to a measure called return on capital employed, which is a financial metric. And the fact is that financial metric is highly subject to things like changes in the valuation of intangibles on the balance sheet, which means that it could go up in a year when the share price goes down. It could go down in a year where the share price goes up. It's for various sort of idiosyncratic reasons. It's not particularly aligned with shareholders' interests, either in a sort of 1 year increments or in some cases over a longer term. So the recommendation from the supervisory board is instead of having 20, 40, 40, with 40% directly sort of aligned with the share price, to go 20% on ESG and 80% aligned with the share price. So hope that clarifies it for you, Stephen.
Hey, and the next question comes from Kevin Grogan from Scrip. Kevin, over to you.
Marvellous. It's just a couple of questions, really, on pharma. Bill, you were saying that, again, going back to Patricia's point, that acquiring phase three assets is an expensive game, a lot of risk. But you've just done the deal with BridgeBio, a very interesting deal, I think it's fair to say. Now, should we expect more licensing deals in certain areas, perhaps, rather than acquiring products? Because the late stage pipeline does still look a bit thin, given that maybe the only filing coming up shortly now will be Ellen's and Attant in the near future. And just one more for Stefan as well. Could you say a bit more about the issues in China that you were referring to and the indirect challenges from the country's anti-corruption campaign? And how long do you think it's going to take before things in China recover for Bayer? Thank you.
Okay. Maybe I'll just give a sort of short answer, and then if there's more needed, we can also turn to Stefan, who has a lot of experience in this field. I think the BridgeBio is an example of a win-win deal. It's good for them because this is a small company that's really getting going with their first launch, and they can focus their energies in the U.S. Meanwhile, we have a large sales force and presence in cardiovascular health in Europe, and it fits right in there. And it's a deal we were able to get on reasonable terms. It's not high risk because the clinical data is already available. And so it's good for us and it's good for them. And I think, certainly deals like that we're always open to. And as Stefan mentioned, we've done over 100 licensing deals in recent years, and you should expect to see that continue. From the question about the anti-corruption in campaign in China, it sort of had an effect over the whole healthcare sector and reducing demand in healthcare in general. That's why we call it an indirect effect, because we weren't involved or implicated in the actual investigations, but it just affects the overall business for many companies in China. And because we have a relatively large share of our business in China, we were more affected than some. So thanks.
Okay, so then we have next one, Amy. We tried again. Donald, I know that you redialed and you have a follow-up question. So Amy, over to you. Let's see that we can get it now online.
Hello again, and apologies if are you able to hear me now?
It works. Yeah, we can hear you.
Yep. Okay. Great. I just wanted to follow up on the question. I think I just basically was cut off, but the consumer bit, the reason I was asking about selling the consumer business and why you might do that, and I understand obviously the tax implications, but if you're thinking about your business and thinking about your debt levels, the US litigation, this would be a way of raising some money to pay down debt, to put money into your drugs pipeline. And if ultimately your plan is to break up the business in the future, I'm not saying it is, but if it is, then why not do it now? And I think I heard one of my peers talk about the fact that there is obviously a number of other businesses out there. There is going to be Sanofi's consumer business, there is Haleon, and there is talk of a lot of private equity interest in these businesses. So I'm just kind of curious as to why that timing wouldn't be right. And then I have just one other question about the US litigation. Somebody was mentioning to me that it might be better, and this might be maybe pie in the sky, but if you could deal with maybe a large law firm that might pool some of these cases together, and therefore you wouldn't be having such regular court cases and the headlines and all of that that's associated with that. And I wondered if that was something that you guys had been thinking about or discussing.
So, Amy, thanks for the questions. I think the question about why not sell consumer health. I mean, I covered most of that area. The simple fact is, we feel pretty good about our ability to fund the kind of rejuvenation in our pharma pipeline that we believe is value added for shareholders. In other words, we don't have $10 billion extra dollars to go make a phase three purchase or a ready to launch purchase. But we do have the funding to fund, the 13 INDs that we got approved in the last 2 years, to do deals like the one that Stefan mentioned with BridgeBio and many others. And we actually think this is the shareholder-friendly way to do this, not to go try to sink a huge amount of money. So we could sell the consumer health business, which has been generating a steady and growing cash flow every year. We could sell it, take the money, and make a big bet on a late-stage asset But we don't think that's a very good idea for shareholders, and so we wouldn't do that. And in terms of you mentioned private equity interest, there's always private equity interest in everything because, you know, that's what private equity firms do, is they buy stuff. But the fact that there's interest and what the price is are two different things. And so I would just keep that in mind. And then regarding the